Welcome to Journals of the Willing from the Tumbling Saber Podcast, a member of the Star Wars Commonwealth Network. Take your first step into a larger world by checking out the network on the web at StarWarsCommonwealth.com, on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. Hey folks, welcome back to Journals of the Willing, our twice monthly look at the printed word from the galaxy far, far away. And with me as always, our good friend Steve. How's it going, man?
Hey Kyle, it's going well. Coming down from this Rogue One high. How are you?
I'm all right, and I guess we haven't had a chance to say Happy New Year to one another yet. Although we've done that via Twitter, but that doesn't really count, does it?
No, it's got to be, I guess not in person. At least you got to hear the person say it.
Yeah,
so Happy New Year.
Yeah, all the best to you and to Dan for 2017.
Thank you. Same to you and the family.
Yeah, well, I guess we're off to a good start. We're all healthy and happy here so far, but freezing our knickers off.
Ooh, it's bitter.
Holy
it's
moly.
Bitter.
People, I think people are probably really fed up of listening to me talk about the weather, but it is remarkably cold.
Oh, it's like pain, like painfully cold, and I hate that. You know, I'm all right with a little chill, but it's at that point where it just feels like pins and needles. That's the worst.
Yeah, and you know, I hate to sound old, but it gets worse as you get older. Like, you just learn to get, I don't know if it's bitterness or if it's just because you're tired of dealing with it for so long, but as you get older, cold just feels worse.
Ooh, man. You're giving me a lot to look forward to.
Well, I had another friend tell me that you don't even feel cold until you hit 30. And I was like, okay. So you have some things to look forward to. You've got a few more years of basking in the comfort of being young.
Oh, boy. Oh, and this weekend was rough. I think I told you Dan and I saw Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark in concert. We were in Jersey. And we parked like 5 minutes from the theater, and even that walk was just so bad. And we had some time, so I was like, hurry, let's get into a pizzeria or something. I need to sit down and eat. It was bad.
Yeah, sometimes it just cuts right through your all your layers of clothing and just gets right to your bones.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's talk about Star Wars.
Yes.
Well, actually, I do want to hear a little bit about this Raiders of the Lost Ark thing.
Oh man, it was amazing. Like Dan said, it was like seeing the movie for the first time. And like that was actually my first time seeing it like on the big screen, which was a different kind of experience. But that on top of, so they had this screen elevated, and below that they had space for like a 30-40 piece orchestra. And they just played along with the John Williams score. And it was just so immersive, and it really made the movie feel alive, you know. And we got like front row seats too. I don't know how he scored that, but it was amazing. And then there were people, I mean, it wasn't like you would think like a super fancy symphony, like people dressed up in suits. Like there were kids and like quite a few adults dressed up as Indy. It was kind of awesome. It was like a little Comic-Con set to music.
That's really cool.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
Was it a local orchestra?
It was the New Jersey Symphony Orchestra. So I guess they're local, but man, they're talented. I think they're doing a bunch of different shows coming up. They were advertising a Looney Tunes, like a Bugs Bunny show, where I guess they showed like a bunch of old clips. And what's awesome about that is a lot of people were introduced to classical music through the old cartoons. So it's kind of coming full circle. I thought that was pretty cool. But I said to Dan, as soon as we left, I was like, I hope someone does this for Star Wars. Like, I would love to see A New Hope like that with a live orchestra.
No doubt. Yeah, I saw a local orchestra do the music of The Force Awakens twice last year. In fact, we had the conductor and the composer. We had him on the show last March, I want to say. And that was the thrill. I had a lot of fun. I want to try and get him back on to discuss Rogue One.
Oh, yeah, and his thoughts on the composition and all that.
Yeah, because at the time, it was still slated to be Alexandre Desplat. And he's, I'm not a fan of that guy. I don't like him at all. So I thought, this is going to be interesting. But I wasn't sure of his feelings on Michael Giacchino. But we'll see if we can get him back on at some point in the near future to discuss Rogue One.
Yeah, I have to say, though, just quickly on the score for Rogue One, it really took the second viewing. I feel like I was able to kind of pick out some pieces of music that I really did like. I guess because after your first viewing, it's just kind of like you're so, you know, taken with the spectacle of it all that the music just kind of flies by and you don't really notice it. But I was really trying to pay attention to the music the second time around. And I honestly didn't even notice the title card music there. Did you notice that it was like a kind of a slight take on the traditional John Williams Star Wars theme? It like had the same two notes, but then it kind of divulged a little bit, you know, diverted.
It sounded familiar.
Yeah. It was like, if you take a look, I couldn't find it on the album though. Like, I don't even know what it's titled under.
I think you're talking about track two. I can't remember the name of it, but it's the second track.
Okay. All right. Because, there's definitely no, like, main title or anything. Like, there's one called Rogue One, but that's later on when they actually say the call sign. But I don't know. I was definitely more, I think, attuned to it the second time.
Oh, yeah. And, as far as the soundtrack goes, I'm giving it the same treatment as I gave The Force Awakens, which is to say, playing nonstop in my car during my commute. It's growing on me. It continues to grow on me. Like, I used to feel like the first almost half, if not two-thirds of the album was sort of ho-hum.
Mm-hmm.
But then I would realize that, oh, man, the last like five or six songs are tremendous. And then it was, the last eight or nine songs are great. And now, half the CD, half this record is really, really good. And it's sort of working my way backwards. And it's now kind of meeting in the middle. It's really solid work, and especially so when you consider, you know, the guy had like 4 or 5 weeks to get it all done.
Oh, totally. Oh, yeah. What he was able to come up with in that time is, you know, really, when you listen to it, it is amazing. It's a lot more nuanced, I think, than a lot of the other scores. He went for a little more. I mean, yeah, they have like the action and the upbeat music, but there's a lot of little nuance and emotional tracks, I think, in all.
Yeah, and there's always that thing in your mind where you know going in that it's not John Williams. So, you know, you're kind of already treating it differently in your mind. And you know this guy does Star Trek, and he does a bunch of Pixar stuff, and he does video games. So you kind of already have that built-in preconceived notion about it. But the more I listen to it, the more I identify with the Star Wars stuff of it. And, I saw a Twitter poll going around. I'm not sure if it's our friends over at Talk Star Wars who ran it, but nevertheless, it was an interesting poll. So would you want to see Giacchino do any more Star Wars music? And I forget what the options were, but we'll make our own here. So you could give it yes, all the Star Wars stuff once John Williams steps aside, whenever that is, or let him do the standalones, or let him do the sagas. Or just give him one more shot for now. Where do you think you would fall?
I think I almost feel the same way about the music as I do with the directors. I think at this point, you know, letting John Williams finish off his run for as long as he can. And, I would kind of like to see different composers kind of have their influence and their take. And kind of, I mean, wasn't that George Lucas's original vision, at least for the directors? He kind of wanted different directors to come in and have their vision be a part of it.
I think you're right. And then once he got to the prequels, he had too specific a vision, right, especially with the technology that he was trying to work with.
Exactly. So it did change over time, but the original trilogy, he kind of wanted different people to come in. So I feel like after John Williams, it would be nice to see different composers come in and add their own flavor. So, I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be a one and done. He could certainly do another one down the line. I wouldn't mind hearing another score from him. What about you?
I'm not quite quite sure where I fall. I kind of, depending on how long the saga is going to go on for, I feel like they should have somebody handling the saga movies and then let the standalones be the, like, the playground where you let different people come in and do it. So I as far as Giacchino goes, yeah, I'm down with letting him take at least one more standalone and see what he does with more time and a little more coordination in the schedule.
Yeah, no, I see where you're coming from with the consistency with the trilogy, having someone come in and, you know, the trilogy and a saga is telling one story. So, you know, you kind of want that feel to go through the saga.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, listen, Steve, we got a voicemail here for Journals of the Willing, which is a first, an absolute rarity. So
that is exciting.
Yeah, let's take a listen and see who it is, and we'll answer this person's question.
Ho, ho, ho! Long-time listener, first-time caller. I'm a contract worker and just finished a very big job. And now I have a few months to sit back, relax, and do some reading. So my question is, what three Star Wars novels would you recommend for someone just getting into the Star Wars novelizations? Any three books, your top recommendations. Have a terrific new year! All the best and long live the Commonwealth! Ho, ho, ho!
And there he goes, Steve. It was old Jolly Saint Nick.
Oh, you know you hit it big when you get a voicemail from Santa.
Santa's a listener of the show. He's a fan of the Tumbling Saber, the Commonwealth. My God, are we ever lucky and blessed to have such a famous listener?
Ooh, man. Hope that means some good presents for us this year. Hopefully.
Well, the Santa, if you're thank you for you know, last week's bounty or 2 weeks ago's bounty of awesomeness. My kids are certainly happy with your performance. And we're happy to answer any questions you have, Santa, as long as it keeps us on the nice list for 2017. So, Steve, your top three. You know what? Santa didn't stress whether he wants to know about what we think are the best novels, or if he's coming at it from a different angle and wants to know what we think are the most important novels.
Right, like the essential reading. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like the info dump versus the page turner.
My list coming up for this, I think it's a little bit of both. I definitely took into account, you know, the impact on canon and the page turning, you know, enjoyment factor. So I think just being timely, I think Santa would probably want to read Catalyst. You know, that was our first review. I think with Rogue One being out, it's a great novel to get into. It ties right into the movie, and it kind of gives you a taste of what these books can offer. So, for sure,
Kevin. I am totally on board with Catalyst being in that list. Not only as one of the best, but also one of the most important. Lucino writes really, really clearly and concisely, and there's a lot of important information in that book. And like you said, it sets up Rogue One and makes you gives you a much better appreciation for the Krennic and Galen Erso relationship.
100%. Tarkin as well. You know, you kind of get
yes,
that triad
that rivalry.
There. Yep.
That rivalry for sure is enhanced by a millionfold if you read Catalyst.
Enhances the emotional factor too. Like, I feel like I would have appreciated kind of the climax of Rogue One. I don't know if we should get into spoilers on this one or not. I don't know. What's your
take? At this point, yeah.
Okay.
The statute of limitations is over. If we want to spoil Rogue One at this point, you know, if anybody out there has still not seen it, shame on you, first of all. And secondly, put your earmuffs on. Go watch Rogue One and come back later.
I mean, I feel like, especially for Krennic's death, like him being at the top of the signal tower, and Tarkin ordering that first shot, he's the first one to get it. You know, I think it still would have been great had I not read Catalyst, but really that's the emotional climax for that rivalry right there. I mean, that's the total power shift. You know, Krennic was denied the position that he wanted. You know, Tarkin ultimately outwitted him, you know, and outsmarted him. So
Yeah, I poor Krennic, right? He's sort of an outsider, so to speak. He's sort of like that scrappy little mutt that just can't make it with the cool dogs. But he's clever and he's ambitious and he's driven and he keeps hanging around the periphery. But ultimately, he did bite off more than he can chew. He did choke on his aspirations, so to speak, and his rival took him out when he had the opportunity.
Yeah, one thing I think that Star Wars does really well is that their villains are always, their demise is always their flaw. You know, Krennic, it's his aspirations. Vader, you know, Anakin, it's his overzealous, his inability to focus on what's at hand, and he lets his emotions get the better of him. So I just think that's something that Star Wars like nails across the board.
Yeah, you can continue that right up the food chain to Palpatine, who, you know, like Luke says in Return of the Jedi, your O for confidence is your weakness.
Yeah. Right up.
Palpatine
there.
Never gave anybody a chance, and yet they smoked him in the end. Actually, Vader got him, and the rebels took out his second precious Death Star.
Oh yeah, and you could see that starting to play out in the new trilogy as well. You know, you got Kylo, his obvious flaws, and makes you wonder where Snoke. You know, Snoke is still quite mysterious, so we don't really know what his demise will be. But that'll be interesting to see develop.
Very much so. Okay, so Catalyst for sure.
And that was on your list?
That's on my list, absolutely. It's in my top three. I'll go next. I will stick with what we've done here with Journals of the Willing, and I'll say Bloodline.
Yep, that was my next.
Another must read.
Yep, that was mine.
we're getting boring here, Steve.
Oh man. Well, we'll see what the third one is. But yep, go ahead. What your thoughts on Bloodline were?
Well, you know, we recapped our feelings on the recently departed Carrie Fisher, and it just so happened that we were planning to do Bloodline anyway within that show. So it was all Carrie Fisher, all Leia that time. And, you know, Claudia Gray absolutely nailed the character of Leia. Like, in a way that we hadn't seen in years. Like, she just got the voice, the attitude, the swagger, the poise, her eloquence, all of it was just nailed so well. And I think what was important is that it sort of gave you a bridge to, politically speaking, what happened after Jedi to at least a few years before The Force Awakens, which is what was sort of a status quo anyway in Episode 7. And it gives you a glimpse, a tease, I guess, as to where the First Order came from, which, let's face it, frankly, we want to see how the First Order came to power. And I think we'll certainly learn more about that in Chuck Wendig's upcoming Empire's End. But Bloodline certainly picks up on that and teases a little more out there. And, you know, it doesn't tell us a whole lot about Luke other than he vanished from public life to set up his Jedi Academy in the post-Jedi years. And we don't learn a single thing really about Ben, Kylo.
Yeah, he's just off with Luke.
Yeah, but you know, I think it tells us a lot about Bail and the history, just the galaxy's political history in those intervening years between Episode 6 and 7, which I thought is really important.
I mean, I will say on Ben though, you know, going back just a sec, you know, we do get a little insight into his relationship with Leia, only in that we know now that Leia has been keeping the Darth Vader secret from him for some time, and we assume now that she was outed in Bloodline. So, you know, now that we're assuming now that that is how we found out.
Yeah. Now, how badly do you want to see the other side of that, where we want to see Ben's reaction to that news?
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting now that, you know, we know how Kylo ends up and how taken with the dark side Ben is. So learning that, and then I guess his meetings with Snoke, it's interesting. You think he would not go that way, you know, but maybe it creates such a rift between him and his family where he's, you know, he doesn't trust them anymore, that, you know, maybe that was just an extra nudge to rely on Snoke.
Yeah, he becomes so enchanted with the idea that, you know, his grandfather was the chosen one, born of the Force, destined for greatness. And, you know, his mom and his uncle seem to have sort of relinquished that mantle a little bit for you know, quote unquote, lesser pursuits. And so he's all in on maybe trying to pick up where his grandfather left off in being Darth Vader 2.0. We know that's what he's up to.
Right.
And the story after story is coming out that he's continuing his sort of quest to be just like Vader.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I feel like we'll get a lot more of that in episode 8. For sure.
Yeah, I hope so. I can't wait to see that guy's story unfold. He was just so compelling. But really, not at all crucial to the Bloodline story. But yeah, I would still put Bloodline on my list at number 2.
Oh yeah, I mean, as far as a character-driven novel goes, I mean, this is our first novel that really... Well, actually, backtrack. We got Heir of the Jedi with Luke. But this is the first novel following a single hero after Return of the Jedi. So, you know, yeah, it does provide that bridge, which I think is phenomenal.
And some really cool characters, too. Ones that I don't know if we'll see again. Joff Seastriker, Greer.
Castarfo.
Yeah, it sounds like he was sent off to die, but...
Oh, yeah, we won't see him again, but...
He was a very compelling character. I thought, you know, at first you hated him, and then you liked him, and then you hated him again. Literally, like, you just had that whole roller coaster of emotions for this guy. You wanted to wring his neck, and then you're like, oh, he's not so bad after all. He's seen the light. He's maturing as a character before our eyes. And then he you love him and hate him.
Yeah, I mean,
you want to see him executed, but then you were hoping that Leia could actually save him.
Yeah, I mean, again, just great character development across the board. Even like we said, characters we're probably not going to see again, you know, before or after that timeline, but still, just fantastic, I think.
Yeah, Lady Carice, so hateable.
Yeah. Love to hate.
So hateable. Corsella, who's briefly in The Force Awakens before being annihilated on Hosnian Prime. She was made very likable. Just a whole buttload of characters in this book that got adequate page time, whatever you want to call it. I think Claudia Gray did a great job. I really hope, fingers crossed, toes crossed, that Claudia Gray gets more work in the Star Wars expanded universe.
I mean, she's 2 for 2 now, so, yep.
All right, now I struggled with my third one, so I'm going to let you kick off the third option for Santa.
Oh, well, we're on the same page. Struggle a little bit, too. I was between two books, Tarkin and Lords of the Sith. Tarkin, because kind of how Bloodline was to Leia, this book is to Tarkin. It's really great character development. You really get into his backstory. You know, finding out what makes him tick, kind of that groomed for the military, kind of lifestyle, what he had to do to train, on his home planet. You get the backstory of why his ship is named what it is. I'm blanking on the name of it right now. Do you remember?
The Carrion Spike?
Carrion Spike. You find out what the Carrion Spike actually is. You get a little bit with Vader, you know, and you just get these dynamics within the Empire. So it just plays perfectly as well with, I think it pairs really well with Catalyst. You know, you read Tarkin, read Catalyst, and then watch Rogue One. And then again, you just see that development across the board.
Now this is, I'm literally 30 or 40 pages into Tarkin. I started it and then I dropped it for Catalyst. And then I got into other things, the holidays. And so I lost track. So I started over, but I'm only about 30 or 40 pages into Tarkin again. Mm-hmm. Is this set? This is set well in advance of Catalyst.
I want to say so. Yeah. We're talking like the beginning of the Death Star construction.
So this is close to Revenge of the Sith.
I should get a list of the timeline, but, it is closer to Revenge of the Sith than Catalyst.
All right. I mean, yeah. So Catalyst does start around around Revenge of the Sith, but ends, I guess a few years after Revenge of the Sith.
So it's kind of, I guess Catalyst then kind of sandwiches the stories a little bit.
Yeah, I think they kind of weave together quite well. So if I don't think it would make a huge difference whether you read one or the other first. Although, again, bear in mind, I have not really gotten even a tenth of the way through Tarkin yet. So that's your third pick, huh? And again, that's James Luceno.
Oh, yeah, again, phenomenal. Well, I hadn't read any of his work prior because he was definitely famous within the old EU. I know he wrote Plagueis, right?
He did Plagueis, and going back further, he did, I want to say, Labyrinth of Evil.
What's that one about?
That is about, I think, Grievous and Anakin. It's sort of a lead-in to Revenge of the Sith.
Okay.
I'll Google that now. I'm going off like a 12-year-old memory here. Labyrinth of Evil. Yeah, my memory serves. It was a 2005 novel by James Luceno. There you go. Novel is set near the end of the Clone Wars and directly before the events of Star Wars Episode III, Revenge of the Sith.
Okay, so he definitely has a strong marking in the EU. So it's awesome that they brought him back.
Yeah, James Luceno is very well versed in writing for Star Wars. He knows how to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
So Tarkin, yeah. Huh?
Tarkin. And then, like I said, I was a little tied between that and Lords of the Sith. Because, if you really like the villains, you get a great dynamic between the Emperor and Darth Vader. Obviously they explore it in the comics as well, but you definitely get a good sense there. That takes place on Ryloth, which is pretty cool. I want to say, Cham Syndulla is in Lords of the Sith. So you get some Clone Wars Rebels tie in there as well.
It's all connected. I do not even own Lords of the Sith yet, but I will.
It's a good read.
Go ahead.
No, it's a good read. And it definitely does a good job at painting Cham as a hero, or, as he was.
Nice. And I think it gives you, from what I've heard, it really gives you a good idea of exactly why Vader is so, obedient and so subservient to the Emperor. Like, exactly why he must obey his master.
Mm-hmm. It's been a while since I read it. I definitely want to go back, maybe take a listen to the audiobook just to refresh some stuff. But you do get that strong dynamic between them. The obedience and whatnot.
Awesome. All right. My third, I kind of struggled with because, again, I have not read all of the stuff offered to us in the new canon EU. So my options are winnowed down to Lost Stars, Ahsoka, Aftermath 1 and 2, and, like I said, the Tarkin book, which I could just Hail Mary into my third slot, but that would be cheating. In the end, I think I'm going to stick Lost Stars in there just for the ease of read and for the it's almost like comfort food. It's a very, very easy read. I can't say that you walk away from that story knowing a whole lot more about the Star Wars galaxy. But it's a cool read, and I like how Claudia Gray, once again, walks you through the events of the original trilogy, like the big events, but from the Imperial side. And it's a story that served to humanize the rank and file members of the Empire, just the regular captains, stormtroopers, officers. You got to know a lot of the people just beneath the mask or under the cap. And you realize that not all of them are bad people. A lot of them legitimately believed in the Empire and what it was doing, were kind of oblivious to the evil underpinnings and totally oblivious to who the emperor really was. And it was, I thought it was really compelling. It was challenging for a longtime Star Wars fan to be asked to sort of get on board and root, not root for, but accept these Imperials as people and not villains that you just want to blast on sight. You know what I mean?
Well, exactly. I mean, that's like the start of, you know, this new wave of Star Wars is asking us to explore the gray area, you know?
Yeah. And the two main protagonists in the book, Sienna Ree and, oh, geez, the guy's name is totally leaving me now.
Oh, I haven't read it yet. I couldn't tell you.
Back to Google.
I have Wikipedia open right now, so. Thane? No.
Yes, yeah. Thane Kyrell. Yes, exactly. Thane and Sienna, it was they were almost given like a Romeo-Juliet type love story where they grew up together, they joined the Imperial Academy together, they fell in love, they were absolutely head over heels for one another. And then Thane starts questioning everything about the Empire, and he's witness to a couple atrocities that has him basically decide, I'm out. And he defects. And it's a good twisting and turning ride to see how these two are going to deal with each other throughout the rest of the book. And it takes you through the events of A New Hope and the destruction of the first Death Star, but it's all seen through their eyes. So Thane takes us through discovering the base on Hoth and living on Hoth in the early going and carrying on through right through the events of Return of the Jedi. It's a really fascinating book. And it actually takes us to Jakku at the end. The book that Empire's End that we mentioned a few minutes ago. The book actually kind of takes us there at the very end, and we'll get more on that, obviously, in Empire's End, but a really, really good book and an easy read. It's aimed at young readers. So the language is not challenging in any respect. So although it's a big, fat book, you can chew through it pretty quickly, and it's not hard to read, and it's a good read. But again, I'm not going to lie to you and say that you walk away from the book and you have a whole fresh set of info about the Star Wars galaxy. It's just a nice, easy read, familiar because of the events, and the characters are great.
All right, so it's like a nice side journey from what's going on that we do know of.
Yeah, and again, Santa, it depends on what you want, my friend. It's if it's a good read, as you sit by the fire, you know, after you've delivered your billions of gifts around the world, then Lost Stars is a good book to unwind to. But if you want to get caught up in the important, the bullet points, the important takeaways from the Star Wars universe, then for sure you're going to want to check out Catalyst and Bloodline at the very least. And I didn't know what to do with Aftermath. Like, what do you do with that? You can't really split it up, right? You can't say, oh, you must read Aftermath Part 1, because it doesn't take you anywhere. It doesn't really leave you with anything important. And the same with Part 2. So could we loophole it? Could we pull a Corey here and say, well, let's wait until Empire's End comes out and then just lump the whole Aftermath story together and give them, you know, give Santa 1,000 pages to plow through. And treat that as one book.
I mean, I imagine Chuck Wendig is planning it out as a trilogy, so I say we could pull a Corey. We can pull it. Because, I mean, it would be hard to recommend. I mean, you wouldn't go to someone who hasn't watched Star Wars and say, oh, you should watch Empire Strikes Back. No, you got to watch New Hope, then Empire Strikes Back, then Return of the Jedi. Not to say, have you read, you know, after you've watched them all, of course you can go back and rewatch your favorites and whatnot, but I think as a full story, you know, it would be doing the trilogy, the book, disservice to just, I think, chop it up. I think we got to see how it all plays out at the end.
Yep, I would agree with that. All right, Santa. I hope we didn't lose you there. That was like a half hour to answer your question there, buddy.
We were thorough. That's what it was.
We were thorough. All right. So what do you say we now talk about The Art of Rogue One? This is a book that I've been dying to get into. So I know you've had your copy for a while. So while I actually have my box here from Amazon that I'm going to crack open here. This will be like my unboxing via podcast. But I'll let you lead the listeners in.
Yeah. So I didn't get a chance to read through all of the forewords and the insights. But I did get to go through kind of bit by bit. They break it up into sections. So, you know, we have artwork for Lamu, Yavin 4, Jedha, Edu, Mustafar, and Scarif. And it's broken up like that. We have original... I hear that unopened. That rip, that very familiar Amazon box.
Yeah, this is. I ordered it and I got it delivered within 2 days. I've got my Amazon Prime membership, which expires in just a few days, but I'm taking advantage of it while I still can.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, look at that back cover shot.
It's gorgeous with the Star Destroyer over Jedha.
Fantastic. That's amazing.
I love my favorite new droid, K2SO, front and center.
How can you go wrong with K2SO?
But speaking of K2SO, I really loved a lot of the concept work that they did with him. I do love the design they went with, but there are some really cool things that they were kind of, you know, snowballing around. And, you know, like there's one, if you go to like page 72... of like him, he's red, all red, kind of looks almost Darth Maul-ish. He's got like these yellow eyes. Really cool, really creepy looking for some of these, which is probably, I feel like they went for the more friendlier version, I guess, which isn't necessarily bad, but, you know, he has a very likable look to him that they went
with. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, these concepts of K2 are, while all cool, I don't think work on the big screen. I think they're all a little bit too much malice in them.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the original idea was, since he was an Imperial droid, they wanted him to have this menacing Imperial feel to him. You know, but I would love to see some of these concepts play into maybe other droids down the line. Which would be really cool. Like, there's one on right before the red artwork on like page 71. He's almost got, it's the top right corner. He's almost got like a scout trooper shape headpiece.
Yes, yes. There's that's a biker scout's profile for sure.
Yeah. So really, just kind of cool things that they were spitballing.
And the one below that makes me, you know, he's got that like TV or almost like a video camera head.
Yeah.
It almost makes me think of Chappie.
Oh, yeah. it's cool. I mean, they could definitely, I think, recycle some of these designs for something else.
And they often do. I have the art of all the prequels in hardcover, and I have The Force Awakens, and I'm the example that most jumps to mind for me is concepts for Darth Maul.
Oh yeah,
and one of them is exactly the Witches of Dathomir from the Clone Wars.
Oh wow!
So they almost literally plucked it right off the page. I think I've said literally like four times today. Corey's rubbing off on me. this is bad. This is I'm going backwards here.
I mean, that's what happens though. Podcasting, he's your brother.
We'll see if Corey chirps back. Again, it's our litmus test. We kind of chirped him in our last episode, and he never said anything. So I know he's not listening.
Got him.
Yeah, no. These art of books are my absolute favorite type of coffee table book, so to speak, reference book in the Star Wars realm.
Mm-hmm.
They're just so cool. I'm now looking at concepts for the U-Wing.
Yeah. I mean, that went through a lot of evolution, too.
Yeah, absolutely they did. Holy moly, like some of these are totally unidentifiable as Star Wars machines. But then again, some, like there's a couple here that I'm like, oh man, I wish they had kind of explored that a bit more.
Right, and you never know. I mean, there's, I'm sure, so many more video games down the line, comic books. They could use these for, I mean, Disney owns this. They could, you know, I think once, if you're a concept artist, you kind of, you know, your artwork belongs to the company you work for. So I think they have access to all of this.
Yeah, I love these books. They're so fascinating.
So if you go to page 185, when they talk about Vader on Mustafar, they've got some grisly artwork there, which I think for a darker Star Wars, it would have worked. It's almost got like a Resident Evil kind of vibe to it.
Yeah, yeah, these are all shots of Vader, you know, what's left of Anakin's body, strapped to all kinds of tables and suspended in Bacta tanks.
I mean, they got the one here with all his limbs cut off, which is like no armor. It's like so crazy, and you wouldn't think that you would see this in a Star Wars movie. So, but it's you know, it's cool that some people are kind of just spitballing these ideas, and you know.
Well, how cool must it be, you know, to be on the other side of this whole thing, to be a concept artist, and you're tasked with this, sketching out some concepts for Vader's healing chamber, and you're sitting there with your pastels or your paints or whatever it is that you use, and you're drawing this unseen glimpse of Darth Vader that no one's ever seen before.
Right.
And that we've all been dying to see.
Yeah. I mean, it's like an artist's dream. I would imagine.
An artist's dream, a Star Wars fan's dream.
There was this, just kind of sidestepping from Vader. It came to mind. I forgot what page was on, but there was an idea for Scarif that instead of the gate just being like a ring hovering above the atmosphere, there's a concept art here where it's a completely artificial ring around the entire circumference of the planet. And it looked really cool.
That would end up being like a structure that would rival the Death Star in its complexity.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's, if you're flipping through, it's 194. Oh, unless that's the Death Star. I think I thought that was Scarif. Maybe that's a Death Star.
What is that? That's a Death Star base planet.
Imperial mining world. Maybe it's just another world that they were thinking of going to.
Oh, but look at that on 195, that other shot of Scarif, which is clearly a Photoshop job.
But
that would
have
been,
yeah,
cool to see just Scarif completely being mined with those giant, you can see the mines burrowing, you know, thousands of feet into the planet's crust. Awesome.
Yeah. I mean, this is something I probably would have liked to have seen in Rogue One. We get a sense of that in Catalyst. You know, this whole idea of the Empire completely disregarding the welfare of these systems and just pillaging them for resources. You know, and you kind of really get a sense of that moral or lack of morality there.
So yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you got the sense that they just did this to dozens, if not hundreds, of worlds.
Right, right. You know, it's crazy. I think I was telling you the other day, or maybe a few weeks ago, a friend who will not be named, a friend of a friend on Facebook, was trying to defend the Empire, and he was saying...
Is he Barney Stinson?
No.
Are you friends with Barney Stinson?
Oh man, it was hysterical. Well, I chimed in, and I started kind of giving some examples, and he's like, "That didn't happen in the movies." I was like, "Well, it happened in canon." I was like talking about the books and everything, and he's like, "Well, for this discussion, just the movies." So I was like, "Well, Alderaan. I mean, that's kind of like the prime example." He's like, "What bad did the Empire really do?" I was like, "Well, they killed people.
they wiped a planet off the right off the galactic map. That's pretty bad in my book.
I mean, if the discussion doesn't stop at Alderaan, then I don't know what else is going to convince the guy. But anyway, I think to convince people like him, seeing more of like this global or galaxy-wide destruction would probably hit home for a lot of people, I guess.
Yeah. How could it? You would have to check the guy's pulse if it didn't.
Sometimes I think people just like to argue on social media for the sake of arguing, but...
No.
That's just a... Yeah.
No. Give people the benefit of the doubt.
That doesn't happen.
There's no divides on social media.
I mean, if you go to, like, the back of the book, they've got, like, these amazing two-page spreads.
Yeah, that's where I'm at now. This is, what, page 240, I think. And it's, you could just tell the artist just was having an absolute blast, you know, shoving in Star Destroyers, at X-Wings, TIE Fighters. Yeah, I mean, I can imagine how much fun this artist would have had.
Yeah, I mean, some of these I would love to blow up and, like, frame and just gorgeous. Like you said, this is like a perfect coffee table book. Put it out, especially when you know Star Wars fans are coming over. And I think people would eat it up.
Oh, for sure. No doubt. You know, a former coworker a long, long time ago, she came to the office one day and she drops this chrome box on my desk. And she goes, "Here you go." I'm like, "What is this?" It looked like a metallic box of chocolates, just to give you an idea of the shape. But in the lower right is sort of an etched, it was an etched version of Padme's ship from Phantom Menace, and it said Episode 1 on it. I'm like, "What?" And I open the box, and there's like this tissue paper. There's not a thank you message, but a type of a whole presentation thing. And then there's like a dozen or 15 super nice prints of concept art from Phantom Menace.
Oh, wow.
I should take a few pictures and post them to Instagram. It's a super set. And I've done nothing with it.
Was that concept art? Was that art that was also in the book, or is that something separate?
No, it was. Yeah, it's pulled out of the art of book.
Okay.
Just blown up and put on super quality paper.
That's cool though. That's really cool, and that's sweet that she did that.
Yeah, and she found it at a garage sale. You know, and bear in mind this was maybe year 2001, 2002 at the most.
Right, so shortly after the film came out, so, yeah.
Somebody bought this and decided that they hated Phantom Menace so much that they would dump all this beautiful set of concept art.
Wow.
Yeah. And found a nice home with me.
One man's trash is another man's treasure, as they say.
Absolutely. I'm looking at this here on page 199. This would have been so cool to see. I hope we see something like this at some point, whether it's Imperial or First Order-like.
189?
Yeah, just this kind of it's sort of like a docking ring for Star Destroyers. So you have maybe 20, 25 Star Destroyers all in a ring.
Oh, I think I'm on Mustafar in 189. Is it 289?
199, sory.
Oh, no problem. Oh, yeah. That's really cool.
I hope we see that.
And that's something that's like on a massive scale. Like, I mean, we get impressed, but we just see one Star Destroyer hovering over a city. That's totally epic if they could pull that off.
Yeah, and why not? I mean, Rogue One to me is possibly the best looking Star Wars film in terms of some of the epic shots and the scale that, you know, that's one of Gareth Edwards' calling cards.
Mm-hmm.
Just delivering epic scale shots.
I still get chills thinking of the Star Destroyer crashing into each other. That, to me, was probably one of my favorite sequences.
Yeah, that's a total nerd out moment.
I mean, because we never saw anything like that before.
No, I mean, in Empire, I think we're led to believe that a couple Star Destroyers crashed into each other because of Han's fancy flying. But you don't. You certainly don't see any of it.
Nope. No, but that docking ring is really awesome.
Oh, I'm seeing some concept art here for Borgalette. That was one. I think that's one aspect of the movie I think I could do without.
Where's that now?
Page 148. That Saw's octopus monster that he used on Bodhi.
Yeah.
I know they try to work in a monster into each Star Wars movie, but yeah. I think I could have done without this one.
Yeah, I mean that's kind of how I feel about the Rathtars in Episode 7. I mean they grew on me a little bit, but I mean maybe this one will grow on me too.
And you know I think that you know they identified monsters as a Star Wars tradition, but they may not have the same enthusiasm and passion for monsters of old classic cinema that George Lucas had, like those old Ray Harryhausen movies, mm-hmm. that you know Lucas could really spin a monster out of that inspiration really well, but others may not be able to pull it off quite as well, but feel like they need to.
Right. I mean, I think a part of it is also, I mean, you know, we look at the Borgalette and we look at the Rathtars. I mean, they're fully CGI creatures. So I'm wondering if we'd feel different if they were practical effect creatures. Yeah, I wonder if they were practical, if we would be feeling a little different.
Probably. I think probably we would.
Yeah.
We talk about these art books and we're kind of gawking over some of the stunning art, but if you read the actual text, like if you read the narrative throughout the book, it really does give you a lot too.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I mean, like I said, I haven't really had a chance to go through all of the text or even 15% of it, but,
I don't blame you. These aren't really like the kind of books that lend themselves well to just sitting down and reading.
Yeah, but if you feel like reading about something in particular, it's kind of, you can jump around and just kind of pick up little tidbits as you go along.
Yeah, exactly. Like those little insights and tidbits on what they were thinking and you know, sometimes these tidbits may or may not be canon, but they certainly make things more interesting.
Oh, wow. Did you check some of the Krennic art on page 46. The big one, you see him kind of like battle scarred, which I think is a very interesting. I mean, if they went with something like that, they would have to kind of explain where that came from. But it's interesting to kind of see him like that.
Yeah. I'm glad they kind of stayed away from that. He seems like he's almost cowardly and vain in that regard.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't... Well, by the end, he was desperate, so he was willing to get his hands dirty on Scarif. But I think at the beginning, he wouldn't. He's not first to run into battle.
No, and they made that clear in the Catalyst.
Oh, yeah.
That he only had very limited combat training.
Mm-hmm. So I think a design like that would definitely go against his character development.
You know, I'm looking at just a couple pages prior to that, page 38. It's the Urso homestead, and there's that sort of beehive shape again.
Oh yeah.
You know, we see the shapes in on Act Two, and we see them in Rebels. Certainly, the landscape on Lothal is very much like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, consistent structure shape. Yeah.
Yeah, just mounds.
I mean, if you flip the page, like 40, 41, I kind of... It's really cool, just that like in-ground base where it looks like there's greenery growing on top of it.
Yeah.
I can't tell if it's greenery or if it was like made to blend in, like almost like camouflage, which would make sense if he's hiding from Krennic.
Yeah, you know what? And we'll wrap up here. But mm-hmm. a thought I have on Rogue One, and I'll try to remember to run this by Corey and James as well, is that the opening scene of Rogue One obviously is Krennic descending on Lamu, and he's found Galen.
Mm-hmm.
and Lyra runs to her little communicator, and she calls Saw and says, "He's found us. He's here." If that was your early warning system, you gave yourself 3 minutes to get out of there. Like that's awful, man. Like your early warning system is garbage.
Yeah.
Like, wouldn't you? You need an entirely different system, something that was going to give you at least 15 minutes to get somewhere. If you were going to get to that little shelter in that cave right. that you built, you needed more than 3 minutes that you gave yourself.
I mean, I guess you run into the risk of if your scanners or something are too powerful, it might be easier for other people to pick you up.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, so.
Or maybe it was intended to be that way. Like, if they ever find us, the scanner is just going to give us enough time to get, you know, Jin and Lyra to the shelter. Like, right. It was maybe never intended to save the entire family.
Right. I mean, you kind of have to hope, as smart as Galen is, that he thought it through to some degree, where he's able to measure the pros and cons of everything.
Yeah.
But, no, it's a fair point, though. Yeah, right. I could get lost in this book, so yeah, maybe we should move on.
Yeah, I think I'm about to get lost in this book. I think that we're going to wrap it up here.
Yeah. So I definitely recommend everyone check it out.
Yeah, I mean, you got. I mean, if you have $30 kicking around, these Artov books are just stunning. They're just so stunning. You have to get these books, and then I would totally recommend The Art of the Force Awakens, which is spectacular. And it would be a good starting point. I mean, I'm lucky enough to have bought the ones for the prequels, which are equally stunning. But I realize at that point to try and get all of them is a pricey task. But certainly get started. These are books you don't want to miss. I know it's perhaps easy to just say, well, I don't want to look at the art that never came to fruition on screen, but it really is a treat to look at where these visuals came from and where the designs came from and what went into them.
Oh, exactly. I'll never forget last year, I bought the Force Awakens art before one of our screenings. I think it was like our third or fourth time seeing Force Awakens. And I can't imagine how silly I must have looked. Dan went off to get like popcorn or something, and I'm sitting in the movie theater with my Art of the Force Awakens. I must have looked like such an obsessed fan in that moment. But it was phenomenal. Yeah, that book I still flip through.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, for sure. Every time, like, I have my bookshelf right next to my fireplace in the basement. And every so often, or whenever I'm lighting a fire, I just yank one of the books off the shelf and I just flip through it for a couple minutes.
Yeah, for sure.
But that'll do for this week for Journals of the Willing. Steve, thanks, man.
Oh, thank you.
My pleasure. And thank you all for listening to our third installment of Journals of the Willing. If you want to get in touch with the show, I'm at, as always, at Tumbling Saber. And Steve, you're at
Joango Fett.
Amazing. And don't forget to check out the Star Wars Commonwealth on Twitter, on Facebook. And also StarWarsCommonwealth.com. And don't forget our friends at Talk Star Wars, Generation X-Wing, Rogue Squadron Podcast, The Skyhoppers, and The Nerd Room. And until episode 58 of the Tumbling Saber Podcast, I'm Kyle, over there with Steve. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon. You've been listening to Journals of the Willing from the Tumbling Saber team, a member of the Star Wars Commonwealth Podcast Network. Learn more about the network and its members at StarWarsCommonwealth.com.